I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. This week, we're talking about civil religion at the funeral for President George H.W. Bush. We're also discussing the religious left's involvement in Mississippi's recent special election for the U.S. Senate. And we'll take a look at allegations of voter fraud by the campaign of a North Carolina Republican who also happens to be a Southern Baptist pastor. While Nish is off this week, I'm joined by an award-winning journalism colleague and friend of the pod, Jack Jenkins. Jack is a superstar reporter for Religion News Service and also a fellow alum of Harvard Divinity School. He recently wrote a fantastic profile of U.S. Senator Cory Booker, asking whether the Democrat could be the candidate of the religious left. We're hoping he'll make this a series, interviewing Democratic presidential contenders over the next few years, and we are incredibly grateful that he could join the podcast this week. We produce Impolite Company with the generous backing of individuals who support us every month. If you like what you hear and think these conversations are valuable, you too can become a sponsor of Impolite Company. Click the link in your player's episode description, or visit patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up. So our first topic this week is an event that took place in the Washington National Cathedral in D.C., where we saw one of the few remaining examples of American civil religion with the state funeral of former President George H.W. Bush. The event was notable for a number of reasons. It took place in the National Cathedral, as a number of high-level ceremonial events do. Most recently, we saw the funeral of Senator John McCain also taking place at the National Cathedral. But the former president was also Episcopalian, so it was fitting that his state funeral took place there and that it was presided over by Episcopal Bishop Michael Curry, who was last seen by international audiences leading the wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle last spring. In addition, we had the somewhat awkward visual of a lineup of former presidents and first ladies with our current president and first lady at the end of the aisle, and a number of unusual veerings from normal practice that those of us who pay attention to religion and politics kind of jumped on and were commenting on, in addition to the appearance of at least one of my teenage heroes, Michael W. Smith, who sang and performed, apparently at the former President Bush's request. So, Jack, you were watching along with the funeral as well. It really is kind of one of these weird things. I've seen people comment that it's as close as America gets to kind of a royal ceremony, the way that we often see things being performed, say, in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in some ways it's a reminder of what the National Cathedral's purpose often is in American civil religion. You know, it was created in many ways, or at least, you know, was intended to function precisely this way, where it kind of has this attachment to power and we're able to have these large American ceremonies, particularly around, you know, presidents, right? And so inaugural prayer services happen there for inaugurations, and funerals happen there for prominent American dignitaries. It's like this really interesting, you know, moment, like you said, of American civil religion, which isn't something that we really discuss as often as we used to, that felt more intrinsic to the nature of American politics, say, circa 1950, than it does today. But it was clearly still alive and well this week at the cathedral, where they put up all of the different bells and whistles, and because it's Episcopalian, the smells and bells, for this sort of service. And so, you know, like you said, it was really curious that way to kind of be reminded of this history the cathedral has with hosting these sorts of events.
It's interesting that you point out that civil religion really is kind of in an awkward space now, because decades ago, and certainly during the 1950s, when Eisenhower famously said that, you know, he thought that Americans should have faith, but it didn't particularly matter what kind of faith it was. There was kind of this flavor of national religion that was, not to pretend that it was ecumenical, it was definitely Protestant, but it was at a time when religion wasn't really a partisan characteristic. And that seems like such an innocent time now, because even with things that you might think of as civil religion, like, say, the National Prayer Breakfast, although that's put on by a private group, the National Day of Prayer, they have all of these kind of partisan and ideological frames around them, so that it becomes a matter of, you know, as a Republican president, quote, bringing prayer back into the White House, or, you know, as a Democratic president showing that they hate God and they hate believers because they, you know, are breaking with the tradition of precisely one president after George W. Bush by not holding ceremonies at the White House for the National Day of Prayer. We rarely get these gatherings that aren't suffused with partisanship and ideology and are just, you know, some national leaders gathering in a religious space and acknowledging, in this case, the faith of one of the former leaders who has died.
Yeah, and I will note that it was unusual, even in comparison to the more recent funeral of John McCain, which had a distinctly more anti-Trump vibe in terms of, one, the fact that Trump wasn't there for McCain's funeral, and two, you know, the message of the many of the speakers, including John McCain's daughter, Meghan McCain. You know, there was this sort of, you know, element of using that space to deliver a message. And you're right. And maybe it was because he is Episcopalian. This was kind of, you know, the one of his spiritual homes, as it were, at least denominationally, is represented by the cathedral, that it was, you know, it was a rare moment, at least during the Trump presidency and really in the modern era, where, you know, the prayers and the messages were infused with, you know, asides of criticisms of other parties or Trump himself. It's an open question as to why that happened to be. Maybe it's just a testament to the kind of presidency that George H. Bush, you know, oversaw, or maybe it's just the fact that this happens to be someone who Donald Trump didn't pick too many fights with, or just his children. But yeah, I mean, I do think this one stood out as a more traditional cultural ritual, the kind that we were used to seeing in the 1950s, when, like you said, it was, you know, more common. Although I will note too that, like, this is also kind of a vestige of the fact that around, you know, the early 20th century, what now would be called liberal Christianity had kind of won. Like, the religious right hadn't risen and hadn't taken hold of the Republican Party in the same way as it did in the later 20th century. And institutions like the National Cathedral and, you know, the National Council of Churches, et cetera, were just the cultural norm for, you know, any mixture of religion and politics. And they, in many ways, they set the tone for what civil religion was. And, you know, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant WASP, you know, moniker kind of came out of that. And George H.W. Bush was, in many ways, a quintessential WASP. Maybe that was one of the reasons that this seemed to fit most comfortably in this space.
Yeah, I have to think, you know, one of the differences between the Bush funeral and the McCain one is just simply a reflection of their two very different temperaments. I don't think it was too much of a surprise to see some feistiness at McCain's funeral, especially since he and Trump were kind of duking it out up through the last weeks of his life. Whereas, you know, Bush definitely made clear his distaste for Trump and didn't vote for Trump. But it would not have done to kind of air that at a funeral. That's not what Connecticut Bushes do. And even though he lived the last half of his life in Texas, at least, those were not his roots. Now, we have to note that Barbara Bush certainly was known for being feisty. So maybe if she had not predeceased him, that would have been a little different. But at the same time, I have to say, when I saw that Michael W. Smith was going to be at the funeral, I thought, I would not have had money on George H.W. Bush's funeral being the one where Michael W. Smith was asked to perform. You know, actually the day before the funeral, one of our former colleagues, Kevin Ekstrom, who used to be editor-in-chief of Religion News Service, where you work, and he's now a top official at the Washington Cathedral, he had posted on Instagram a picture of him with Michael W. Smith. And just kidding, I had commented and said, Kevin, is there going to be a performance of Friends at the funeral tomorrow? And I was not trying to like put him on the spot. I was just kidding. And sure enough, listeners, there was a performance of Friends, which I guarantee you, you could put me in front of a piano right now and I could play from memory. I played it so many times at so many Baptist youth jamborees.
What I was surprised by too, and came to find out after some research, and Kate Shelnut wrote a great article about it and Christianity Today, apparently Michael W. Smith and the Bushes were just friends. Like they were, and then they used to travel together. Apparently the last time that Michael W. Smith saw George H.W. Bush, he like, you know, gave him a hug, pointed in the air and said, friends are friends forever. You know, there's apparently this whole relationship. Apparently, you know, even George W. Bush refers to Michael as the real W. So, you know, I had no idea. And it got to the point where apparently Michael W. Smith and George H.W. Bush would like call up Billy Graham and like have a group conversation about faith together. Again, had no idea that they would hang out, which, you know, I think you would know, seems a little, you know, given that George H.W. Bush is more of a Episcopalian, you know, more of a WASPy fellow.
Yeah, he is not a stereotypical evangelical who was hanging out at Amy Grant and Michael W. Smith concerts. And yet, apparently, he has attended one or two of them and had Michael W. Smith come perform, I think, at the White House when he was president. That's where they initially met.
George H.W. Bush, contemporary Christian music fan. Did not see that one coming.
Yeah. Well, although, you know, the religion and politics nerd in me feels like I want to dig even deeper, because during his father's presidency, George W. Bush, his only portfolio during that administration was being the conduit for white evangelicals. And I have to think he was definitely more aware of who the pop music superstars were in the Christian world than his dad. And I wonder if he was responsible for getting Michael W. Smith into the White House in the first place and therefore getting them together. But this all... it makes so much more sense now, because Michael W. Smith also performed at the 2004 Republican National Convention, where I sat seething because I was so annoyed, because I see that as very different than, like, you know, Amy Grant comes and sings in the White House during an Obama Easter breakfast, or Michael W. Smith sings for a Bush Christmas party. Those seem less out and out partisan than bringing somebody to a convention.
Like, literally the party convention. Yeah.
I am willing to let bygones be bygones now, knowing a little more about their personal friendship. But we did not bring this up as a topic just so I could reminisce about Michael W. Smith. What I did want to talk about is that before the funeral was even over, people were chattering about the fact that there was a recitation, as there is in every Episcopal service I've ever been to, of the Apostles' Creed, and that everyone in attendance, and certainly all the former presidents and first ladies, appeared to be reciting it. It was printed in the program, and so you've got the words right there. I'm sure Bill Clinton was reciting it from memory, because he memorizes everything that has to do with the church. But Trump and Melania, they stood with their hands folded, not looking at the programs and not reciting the creed at all, which led some people to want to discuss whether he disagrees with portions of the creed. Frankly, I would be surprised to learn that he knew any part of the creed enough to think, well, you know, I've got some theological questions about the literal aspects of the resurrection and whether I want to affirm that.
Yeah, it was super surprising. It was right there in the bulletin. Like, you could see it and, or even mouth the words along if you hadn't heard it before. It was just such a peculiar thing to not do. And that, you know, I heard some people immediately say, well, you know, he might be catering to some evangelicals who, you know, who don't apparently say the creed with as much regularity or at all as you might find.
Yeah, but he wouldn't know that.
Well, that's the thing. He was raised Presbyterian. And he grew up, you know, after he left, you know, what is now a Presbyterian Church USA church, he was at Norman Vincent Peale's church. And I have a hard time believing that Norman Vincent Peale's church didn't also say the Apostles' Creed. Like, how would you not have heard it? I was flummoxed by that one. I didn't see that one coming.
Well, it has been a very long time since he was reportedly a somewhat occasional churchgoer. That was, I believe, the height of it was when he was dating Marla Maples and they used to sneak out and meet at church, which we could do a whole episode, yeah, on that. But I have watched kind of with some humor the debates about this, both because it seems to take this far more seriously than I think he is capable of thinking about the Apostles' Creed. But also, as you know, I love a good debate about any religion and politics topic. But it just seems so clear to me that this was not about the creed. I mean, he didn't sing any of the hymns. He sat through the service mostly with his arms crossed and a very sour expression on his face. But mostly what he reminded me of was a petulant teenager who's like, you can make me go, but you can't make me like it. You know, he's not allowed to miss a funeral of a former president. The McCain family made clear they didn't want him there. He didn't want to be at McCain's funeral. He misses it, fine. But he can't sit out this one. He has said so many times that we have to take him at his word on this, that basically his biggest metric in life for judging people is, have they said nice things about him? And George H.W. Bush had not said nice things about him, hadn't said awful things about him, but, you know, had taken some digs and didn't vote for him. And so I don't think he wanted to be there. I think he was just going to be churlish. We got some fawning from political observers for not, I don't know, mooning the gasket or something. But, you know, this was just not a guy who wanted to be there and participate. I think that's the end of the story.
He certainly didn't look excited during the service at all.
He did give a thumbs up afterward.
Right.
And said he was looking forward on Twitter. He tweeted something about looking forward to the funeral, which, again, no human talks like that.
Interesting.
Let's move on. Some reporting came out late last week about some shenanigans in North Carolina, where we are learning now about what seems incontrovertibly to have been a calculated effort by some Republicans to steal a congressional seat down there.
Yeah, it's pretty. I think the term that's being thrown around is election fraud, and the precise thing that drew authorities' attention to the race was that they noticed that there was an unusually high number of mail-in ballot requests in Bladen County, in, you know, the North Carolina 9th District, and that there were also an unusually high number of unreturned ballots. Mail-in ballots, you know, compared to the rest of the state, and particularly among African-American and Native American voters. And so this led to various investigations, both from election authorities and local and national news outlets, parsing, you know, what seemed to be this race, this would turn out to be a very tight race between Republican Reverend Mark Harris, a Southern Baptist minister, and a Democrat and former Marine Corps veteran, Dan McCready, who were only separated by 905 votes. And as it turns out, there is now allegations that one person, individual, Leslie McCrae Dallas, who was hired by an outside group to work for the Republican Mark Harris's campaign. They have now run into people who said they were working for Dallas and were paid to go take ballots from people at their doors and say, hey, if you have a mail-in ballot, hey, I'm going to take it from you. And it is unclear if that on its own is illegal, like to take any ballot from a voter and not have them submitted itself, whether that is legal under North Carolina law. And it certainly looks like it's not. But it, even those workers are saying that they're not sure what happened when they gave the ballots to Dallas, this individual working for Harris's campaign in Bladen County. When they handed it back to them, they're not really sure what he did with these ballots. And there's concern that if they were, supporting the Democrat in the race, that they may have been thrown out. And so you get down to this, really kind of old school version of election fraud. And it's worth noting that this, Dallas was not unknown to Reverend Mark Harris, the Republican candidate, because apparently last year, when a member of Harris's own church decided to run for office in the Charlotte area, Harris actually introduced him to Dallas, saying that he was really good at getting out absentee votes.
Well, and what's unusual here is it's not just North Carolina Democrats who are up in arms, because there are allegations that this may have been how he won the primary as well, to even be the Republican nominee for this House seat, that was a really contested race, and that there were also a surprising, suspicious number of outstanding absentee ballots for that race as well.
I will also note, speaking of the Reverend Mark Harris, this is a particularly awkward controversy for him because he has made a name for himself in the state of North Carolina as this moral cultural crusader.
Did the words "drain the swamp" come out of his mouth, Jack?
I don't know. Did they? Do you know? Did he say that? I do know that he's in many ways fits this archetype for a Southern religious right figure. He campaigned in 2012 for North Carolina's Amendment 1 that banned same-sex marriage in the state. He was a vocal supporter of a bill that would have mandated that men's and women's restrooms and government buildings be used by people. You would only use the restroom that fit with the gender that was listed on your birth certificate, which was widely seen as transphobic. He also got in trouble during the campaign because they went through his old sermons and they found that one of them, he questions whether women should pursue careers in lieu of pursuing biblical womanhood. And also apparently in earlier sermons referred to Islam as, basically the work of Satan and dangerous, and said that there can't be peace between Israelis and the Palestinians until Jews and Muslims convert to accept Jesus Christ as the savior. So he was an interesting figure even before any of this controversy. There was actually a lot of questions as to whether or not he could genuinely win, especially considering, given all of that, his opponent, Dan McCready, wasn't some sort of, caricature of a secular, godless liberal.
He was a really strong candidate.
Yeah, he was a really strong candidate. And in terms of faith stuff, he actually, on the front of his website, he said that he had, while serving in Iraq, had been converted to Christianity by some of his fellow soldiers and was baptized with water from the Euphrates River. And so, this wasn't like he was up against someone who he could, just cast aside as someone who is, a liberal hack, as it were. So, yeah, it's an awkward moment for Mark Harris right now.
And how poetic that one of the obstacles facing him right now is that regardless of what the state of North Carolina decides to do in terms of certifying this election, Nancy Pelosi, the incoming Speaker of the House of Representatives, could decide not to allow him to be seated. A woman who is not staying home to submit to her husband, but has decided to pursue a career in politics. I just kind of love that poetic justice.
The stuff that keeps coming out, like even Republican commentators are like slowly backing away.
Have you seen anything from Southern Baptist leaders themselves, or are they staying away from this with a 10-foot pole?
See, that's a curious thing to me. I have not seen many Southern Baptist groups speak out. And it's worth noting that one of the people who, vocally, if not endorsed, but at least backed his campaign was Tammy Fitzgerald, who is the executive director of the North Carolina Values Coalition, but also a trustee for the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission.
Oh, yikes.
So I am curious if this continues to move forward, whether you'll start to hear from people like Russell Moore and others to say, you know, maybe this wasn't. I mean, especially if, you know, again, right now it's all allegations, but if they prove, if it is proven that there is some sort of connection that Mark Harris actually was aware of this sort of, you know, what appears to be election fraud and, you know, instigated it, I feel certain the Southern Baptist Convention would get a lot of questions, you know, in terms of whether or not that fits with their definitions of ethical behavior and ethical leadership.
Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's absentee ballots. I'm pretty sure that's one of the 10, but we'll have to check in one of the courthouses that requires the display of the 10 commandments to know for sure. For our last topic, we have something that's a little unusual, only in that it's a conversation Jack and I actually recorded a week ago, before we knew he would be the guest co-host for this episode. And it was recorded while I was recovering from a head cold, which is why I may sound a lot like a dying toad. Anyway, we talked about the special election that had just wrapped up in Mississippi and the involvement down there of some religious left leaders in reaching out to voters. We hope you enjoy it. So, Jack, you share our interest in the religious left and the fact that it exists as a thing. And most recently, have been paying attention to the involvement of religious left leaders in the Mississippi Senate race, which wrapped up in the reelection of Cindy Hyde-Smith. Despite that expected result, we were hoping you could tell us a little bit about what was going on there in the weeks leading up to that special election.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things to keep in mind is that, you know, obviously this runoff election in Mississippi is taking place in one of the reddest of red states, right? You know, this is one of those places where a Democrat winning statewide office seems, you know, like a distant dream for Democrats. But at the same time, you know, one of the things that we saw ahead of this election is one that SP had, you know, the Democrat had a chance, that there was some semblance of a chance that this Democrat could, you know, win this Senate seat. And secondly, it was notable where SP actually did a lot of his campaigning, which was in churches. You know, he actually, a lot of his events were convened in churches across Mississippi and, you know, involved different people in the churches, knowing that that was both a sacred space, but also a place where they were going to go see who they, you know, if they were Democrats, who they hoped would be the next senator from their state. So then, you know, in the days leading up to the actual runoff election, you started seeing people like Reverend William Barber II, one of the co-founders of the Poor People's Campaign, which is this national campaign to lift up poor people, but also involves itself in a lot of other advocacies. He also, of course, helped found the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina that is credited with actually unseating a Republican governor in that state. And so he started actually crisscrossing the state. And just a few days before this runoff election, he was in Biloxi, Mississippi, holding a Get Out the Vote event in a church. And once again, you know, both decrying what he saw as, you know, sinful policies promoted by SP's Republican opponent, but also trying to encourage people of faith, particularly non-white people of faith, to make sure that they show up to the polls to vote for, you know, a Democrat. And that was an interesting trend when coupled with the fact that you also had, you know, heavy-hitting politicians like Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, who were also, you know, deployed down to the state of Mississippi to kind of campaign on SP's behalf. And Booker in particular is interesting because Booker has often shown up at religious left events. He often has also spoken in churches at national conventions of denominations in the past. Someone that Democrats have sent to churches and to, you know, to help energize votes for Democrats. Now, those two data points, just having William Barber and Cory Booker on their own, you know, might not seem like a lot, but you have to remember that this mirrors what happened last year in the Alabama Senate race. So, you know, Reverend William Barber on his own doesn't represent the entire religious left. Neither does Senator Cory Booker. But although, to be fair, he has now been referred to as a as resembling an evangelical minister by the Associated Press, Cory Booker has, so to give you an idea of how closely tied he is to the religious left these days, which is why it's interesting that this sort of advocacy by William Barber and Booker was happening in Mississippi this go-round because it looked a whole lot like what happened in Alabama last year during the special election there between Roy Moore, the Republican, and Doug Jones, the Democrat, where again, you had Reverend William Barber crisscrossing the state, decrying Roy Moore, and you had Cory Booker, who was actually standing next to Doug Jones, as in the final hours of the campaign, the two of them went and campaigned in primarily black churches right ahead of that election, which of course resulted in the unseating of a Republican. Now, granted, there was a lot of other things going on in the Roy Moore campaign, but you're starting to see a decent level of organized activism among the religious left, particularly around organizing non-white religious voters in southern states.
Well, and we should just point out that even though, as you said, the Republican was expected to win in the Mississippi Senate race, and she did end up holding on to the seat, the previous few elections were by a much bigger margin. She ended up getting slightly under 54% of the vote. And previously it had gone by 60%, 57%, 58%. So this was a closer race, if not, you know, a tight margin. It is closing the gap in a state where Democrats have simply not been able to play.
And I think one of the things that people forget about these southern states is just how many religious voters there are in general and how potentially powerful the non-white faith voters can be. So actually, Pew Research unveiled some data earlier this year where they showed that in general, states that show a citizenry with a higher than average worship attendance, those states tend to skew more Republican. However, the non-white individuals in that state who are religious skew more Democratic than non-white voters in other states. And so they become some of the most Democratic Democrats, as it were, throughout the South, which is why it wasn't particularly surprising when ahead of this midterm election, you had people like William Barber alongside head of Faith and Public Life, Reverend Jennifer Butler, holding similar GOTV events in Georgia and Florida. And actually, the last night before the midterm election in Georgia, they had a big get-out-the-vote rally at Ebenezer Baptist Church, the former church where Martin Luther King used to preach in. You had like basically an all-star cast of the religious left, where you had politicians like Representative John Lewis alongside Reverend Jesse Jackson, as well as Reverend William Barber and Jim Wallace and Tracy Blackman of Ferguson, Missouri, all of them speaking, you know, and encouraging people to get out the vote the next day and speaking primarily to a non-white religious audience. And I think there's something to that, that whether it's on purpose or just because these faith-based activists are just particularly energized, you're starting to see Democrats benefit from this kind of activism and this sort of, you know, vote-getting tactics from, what, for lack of a better term, the religious left.
Is there any reason to think that national Democrats might take a look at the religious left's work in Alabama and Mississippi Senate races and decide maybe they'd finally invest in some religious outreach in 2020?
The truth is, it would be really surprising to me if a 2020 Democratic candidate didn't use this sort of strategy in the future. It would be really...
Jack, can I introduce you to the Democratic Party?
Well, here's why I say that. Because some of the candidates that are already looking like potential front runners, or at least the people who are most likely to run come 2020, include people like Senator Cory Booker and Senator Elizabeth Warren, as well as Kamala Harris and others. And all three of those people in particular, Harris and Warren and Booker, have had a lot of face time with William Barber, who, you know, is one of the big leaders of the religious left at this point. In fact, earlier this year, you had Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker went and spoke at the Festival of Homiletics, which is a preacher convention of mostly white liberal mainline pastors in Washington, D.C., which is not a typical thing for either of them to do. And Cory Booker spoke for 45 minutes, and the head of the Festival of Homiletics almost like virtually endorsed him. And when Elizabeth Warren was speaking, she literally waved a Bible around while talking about having these shared progressive values in what sounded a whole lot like a campaign speech. And both of them, you know, sounded like they were workshopping a sort of faith-based message. My running theory on this, and this is just raw speculation, is I think some Democrats see the potential for states that in the past hadn't been in play for Democrats, or states that Democrats lost in 2016, particularly North Carolina, they might be able to play really strongly in if they take certain kinds of faith outreach seriously. And so I would think that, one, you could see the potential for a Cory Booker or Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren election campaign really leaning into those sorts of things. And two, I do think you could even see them using these sorts of activists to kind of push up the margins in states like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin. When it comes down to, you know, 10,000, 20,000 votes in those states, as it did in 2016, Democrats are going to use whatever they can to run up the score wherever they can. So I wouldn't be surprised if they threw everything against the wall. And while Democrats haven't exactly been great at religious outreach by a lot of metrics in the past, they might embrace that and every other form of outreach come 2020.
From your mouth to the DNC's ears.
Well, I do think that at some level, there's just a math problem here. That I think if you're a Democratic strategist, you see things like, yes, you know, Democrats lost in Florida and Georgia and now Mississippi. But they did win in Alabama. And as you pointed out, Amy, in Mississippi and in Georgia and Florida, they came closer than they have in a long time. And there's something to be said for, you know, if you invested in these sorts of outreach programs earlier or more heavily in combination with any number of other kinds of outreach that the Democratic Party does, that you could, again, run up the score and push in the margins. Because that seems to be what these sorts of races come down to that often result in recounts, right? So, you know, whatever you can do to push that a few thousand votes higher, I think they're going to talk about.
So let me just throw the professional Democrats pushback at you on this, which is that they see so often religious Democrats as in opposition to religious nuns, which they know as well as we do are a fast growing segment of the general population and the largest growing segment, I believe, of the Democratic base. And so you can see why in a race in, say, Mississippi or Alabama, professional Democrats might think, well, you know, reaching out to religious voters, letting the religious left come in and do its thing, that's not exactly going to be scaring off large numbers of religious nuns because we just don't think there are many of them in those states, even though they might be surprised. But, you know, start looking into some other states that are maybe purple or, God forbid, mostly blue. And we get worried, even though there's no evidence to back this up, that religious outreach would actually alienate those religious nuns who we think are the future and worth focusing on more.
I do think this is an interesting tension in the Democratic Party because, as you note, you have anywhere from a quarter to a third of the Democratic Party that is religiously unaffiliated, the nuns, as you noted. And that group often, you know, in polling reflexively does not respond well to religion in a podium coming from a political standpoint.
And yet they don't respond negatively.
Exactly. And so it's interesting that you have the other three quarters to, you know, two thirds of the Democratic Party that cites a religious affiliation. And several of those people actually have significantly higher religious attendance than even many Republicans. So the Democratic Party arguably has some of the most and the least religious people under its same umbrella. And so I will say that traditionally there's a lot of conversation about, you know, how would we do this in a way that, like you said, wouldn't alienate people. In fact, when Cory Booker was asked by Politico whether he would run as a progressive Baptist per se, he seemed to demur and say, you know, that might alienate people. But at the same time, he doesn't necessarily shy away from using religious rhetoric on the stump. And as you know, religiously unaffiliated Americans don't necessarily rebuke religious language when it tends to line up with the policy positions they hold. So religious individuals who embrace LGBTQ relationships and rights, for instance, of which there are many religious left leaders, religiously unaffiliated in the Democratic Party don't necessarily reject them. And I think this is important. We're in a particular political moment where when it comes to the resistance, you know, all of these different protests that have been happening on Capitol Hill and across the country in opposition to the policies of the Trump administration, a lot of that has been led by religious leaders. And I think that even diehard secular progressives get that. And while they may not be super excited about religion in general, they do see a united front, as it were, in rejecting Trumpism and the GOP. And I see that sort of collaboration across the board, not just secular and religious. A lot of groups that might not get along in the past are suddenly uniform in opposition to Trump and his supporters. And so that, in a way, Trump has created a new form, a newfound coalition within among progressives, where things that might have divided them in the past unite them simply because of the Trump moment. And at the end of the day, when, you know, you have people like Linda Sarsour, who came out of religious left circles, and you know, she helped organize the Women's March, and people like William Barber, who was speaking at the 2016 Democratic National Convention, and Sister Simone Campbell, who spoke at the 2012 Democratic National Convention. There's been a sort of mainstreaming of these voices among progressives. And I think secular folks are less likely to balk at them like they than they may have been, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 years ago.
Well, we will wrap up our show this week with our regular praise and petition segment, in which we shout out the things that are bringing us joy and offer occasional petitions. Jack, what's been going on with you this week?
So in terms of praise and petitions, I have two cultural things that have sustained me. One is I just finished John Scalzi's The Consuming Fire, which is the second in one of his new science fiction series. I'm a science fiction guy. And it actually deals heavily with religion and with the concept of prophecy. It's set in this hypothetical future where Earthlings, as it were, have colonized the planet, but we are colonized the galaxy, but we were only able to do that because this mysterious force appeared called the Flow. And we are able to just jump into it, and it just takes us like a river to certain places, and we can jump out. And so they built an entire economy around it, and they built an entire church that is one of the foundational structures of the society to help, you know, maintain order. And then the Flow began to collapse. And so now society and the church are having both, you know, practical and existential and theological crises all at once. So I've been enjoying that. And John Scalzi's writing is also very funny. So that's helpful. And the other thing is, and I know that this is just the most stereotypical thing for a religion writer to be interested in, but so Sufjan Stevens had 11 years ago held this contest around the holiday season. And he said, if you send me all your songs, fans, and the one I like the best, I will trade you one of my songs for that one on my album. And what he meant by that was that he literally recorded a song. And when this one piano player won, he recorded it by himself, didn't let anyone else hear it, packaged it up and sent it to that individual and said, you now own the rights to this song completely and entirely. And it's called The Lonely Man of Winter. And then I'll own your song and put it on my album. And they shared it. So, you know, Sufjan Stevens went and published his album with this person's song on it. But the individual actually thought that it was really cool that he had this kind of secret song. So he started holding these listening parties around Christmas time every year. People would come over in groups of four and they would, you know, drink hot cocoa, and they would only, you know, four at a time listen to this song on headphones. And he did this for like 10 or 11 years to just kind of, you know, preserve the prestige and the, you know, the immaculate nature of the song. But he ended up forming a nonprofit in New York City that helps out artists and activists. And to fund it, he decided, well, maybe I'll just sell the song. And so he finally, you know, gave it back, or he published the song via Sufjan Stevens' own record label, Asthmatic Kitty. And so now there's this beautiful song. It's absolutely gorgeous that apparently the story is that Sufjan Stevens had also not heard it for 11 years. Like he himself had not, he like recorded the song and forgotten it. And so now I just got the new vinyl of it this week and have been listening to that on repeat like a nerd.
How weird and how interesting. And that actually, that leads perfectly into one of the things I was going to highlight, which was a reminder and maybe new information for listeners who weren't with us last year, that we have a playlist at Spotify called An Impolite Company Holiday, which contains my carefully curated playlist of mostly Christmas and Hanukkah songs, because here in the Sullivan Scheiber household, we are right in the middle of trying to balance Advent and Hanukkah at the same time. So we've got some Advent songs, some Hanukkah songs, a little bit of Christmas, and I'll have to add that to the playlist. But I'll put the link in our show notes, or you can go to Spotify and just search for An Impolite Company Holiday. I've been listening to that nonstop, and I will need to add this song so that can be in my constant rotation. One of my gifts every year is that Noam takes the kids to his parents for Hanukkah, and this is the one Jewish holiday that I get to kind of skip. So I get to stay home and just run around for the first 12 hours going, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? I've got all this space. It's mine, 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 mine. And I just had to tell this story of one of the things that they did. His folks live in New Jersey, so he usually takes the kids into New York at some point. And apparently over the weekend, they went to see play/performance. That is one of those things that would have scarred me as a child because I was so shy. But we have a child who was not shy. And as part of this performance, the main actor did a lot of interaction with the audience. And so he would kind of like, if you've been to an improv performance, they'll like have you call out things. So he had people call out, you know, what's something you could be scared of? So they yelled spiders, you know, what's a favorite animal? And then he called on our little guy, Cormac, and said, you know, give me the name of a celebrity. To which Cormac, of course, said, Amy Grant.
Yes.
Which I do not think is what anybody in this New York City theater was expecting a five-year-old little boy to name as his celebrity. But I feel so vindicated as a parent by this.
You're raising him right.
Yes. And what I have been waiting to show him, because he was gone when it aired, is Amy Grant has a new television Christmas special that was on the Hallmark Channel this Monday. So I cannot wait. This weekend, we are going to sit down and we are going to watch Amy Grant. His little mind is going to be blown because so far he has seen, I think it was the 1986 special she did on CBS, which I, of course, taped on our VCR when it originally aired, and then watched that little puppy over and over and over. It just continues to blow my mind that although we are very consciously raising interfaith kids, I have somehow ended up with a child who is obsessed with God and theology and Amy Grant. And I should just not question it and just enjoy it.
No, just let that flow. That's just let the spirit move. And that's that context. That's amazing.
So this is my public service, is that if you did not know there was an Amy Grant Christmas special out there, treat yourself and go watch it. And lastly, and I don't want to put you on the spot, Jack, but I was reminded again this morning, news from another one of our colleagues, that it's been a tough year. It's been a tough year for the country and at a macro level, but this has been more than any other year I can remember, one in which a lot of friends and a lot of colleagues have dealt with the loss of a parent. And heading into the holidays, I just want to put out there as a petition that this is a tough, tender time for a lot of folks, that while there's happiness to be had in baking Christmas cookies and putting up decorations and singing carols, just spare a thought for folks for whom this can be a bittersweet time. So that's all I'll say. But
really
we're thinking of you and we're with you.
Thank you. And for the listeners, just so you know, my father passed away this year, and it is, holidays are hard. And one thing that has sustained me in that grief is that there are a lot of other people who have gone through loss, and it is really helpful when they reach out. And so thank you for doing that just now. But also, you know, don't be afraid if you see somebody hurting or wounded to just say howdy and just check on them.
I'm so glad you reminded people. That's all for this week's episode. Thanks for joining us. Impolite Company was produced this week by me. So please excuse any mistakes and definitely don't blame them on our regular long-suffering producer, Constantine. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us, and we're so grateful for your recent reviews. If you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.